This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The House votes on the tax deal. Look out for the next real estate bubble, everybody, and napping on the job, the next best way to worker productivity. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 16th of December today, and here's where we are on the House vote on the tax package. We're waiting, biding our time, hanging around while House Democrats argue mostly with each other over how to deal with the estate tax. When that vote does happen, and most everybody does expect the deal to pass, we'll finally get a chance to see whether the economy really needed to be stimulated with more borrowed money. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the latest.
The compromise keeps income and business taxes where they've been the last 10 years. It's also designed to jumpstart the economy with a year-long 2% cut in Social Security payroll taxes, and companies get a write-off for new plants and equipment. President Obama says these tax breaks are necessary.
I am absolutely convinced that this tax cut plan, while not perfect, will help grow our economy and create jobs in the private sector.
But the economy is showing fragile signs of a turnaround. Does it really need more stimulus? Or could the extra injection of government cash overshoot the mark and stoke inflation? Moody's analytics economist Mark Zandi says there's a small chance of that. But he says the alternative, raising tax rates on all Americans, would be worse.
If we go back into recession, it's going to be a world of hurt. There is no policy response to that. Our deficits would balloon out. So it's prudent to err on the side of perhaps doing too much rather than too little.
Still, the tax compromise also adds hundreds of billions to the deficit, and some question whether temporary tax breaks deliver much bang for those bucks. Gerald O'Driscoll is a former vice chairman of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. He says the payroll tax reduction will hardly be noticed.
Because people know they're temporary, they know they're transitory, and they're going to save most of it.
And if Congress finds it difficult to let the payroll tax holiday end next December, O'Driscoll says the revenue loss will have real consequences for Social Security solvency. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
For finance nerds or for people who just have trouble falling asleep sometimes, boy, have we got good news for you. Today was the very first time that the Federal Reserve broadcast one of its meetings live online. Had you happened to have tuned in this afternoon, you'd have heard a detailed discussion about something called debit card interchange fees, what retailers have to pay when you use the cards. The Fed wants to limit those fees. Retailers think it's a fine idea. The banks, however, don't. And Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports the banks are expected to make up the lost revenue in other ways.
Until now, when consumers used a debit card, merchants had to pay a fee of about 2% of the sale. These fees cover the cost of the transaction between the merchant's bank and the customer's bank. The Federal Reserve's new limit will cap those fees. The most merchants will pay for a debit card purchase of any size is 12 cents. This is a huge hit for banks, costing them billions of dollars in lost revenue. Scott Talbot is chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable, an industry trade association.
As the banks that are involved in the transaction are unable to recoup their costs for operating this service and allowing merchants to accept debit cards, we're worried that those costs will be shifted down to the consumers.
He says some debit cards may soon charge annual fees. Others may charge a fee for each debit card transaction.
we could see a loss of debit cards being offered altogether. Certain institutions won't offer debit cards because it is not profitable for them.
With debit cards looking less profitable, banks will find revenues elsewhere. Gwen Bazar is research director with Aite Group. He says consumers can expect new fees for other banking services.
We're already seeing like overdraft fees going up. You are going to see more banks dropping free checking accounts.
But there is an upside for consumers, too. Merchants could pass along some of the money they save in debit fees. Especially where competition is tight, retailers could ultimately shave a few pennies off their prices. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
What I'm about to say is going to take less than 140 characters, but carries with it a message that speaks volumes. Here you go. Begin counting. Twitter could conceivably be worth almost $4 billion. That's the extrapolation from a $150 million chunk of the company that was just sold to a big-name Silicon Valley venture capital firm. Marketplace's Steve Henn does the math.
A couple weeks ago, the legendary venture capitalist John Doerr from Kleiner Perkins was asked about Twitter at a conference in San Francisco.
How did you miss that one?
You know, we turned down Twitter when it had no traction and the idea wasn't clear, and we were wrong.
Today, Doerr's firm rectified that mistake, making a big investment in Twitter that set the value of the company at $3.7 billion. That's almost twice the current value of the New York Times. Lou Kerner's an analyst at Wedbush Securities.
If you think of Twitter as being a media company, what media companies are really all about is aggregating an audience. And Twitter is successfully aggregating a massive audience.
Kerner believes the money will come. And right now in Silicon Valley, this is how they're doing the math. Big social networking companies like Twitter and Facebook trade at close to 40 times their current revenue. And that's revenue, not profits. Apply that equation to Apple, and that company's suddenly worth $2.4 trillion instead of its current market cap of $290 billion. Do Twitter math on Exxon, $11 trillion instead of the paltry $390 billion it's actually worth today. Okay, I know there are probably 3.7 billion reasons you can't compare Twitter to ExxonMobil, but let's just say for Kleiner Perkins' $150 million investment to pay off, Twitter will have to grow exponentially for years. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, boy, I bet they're just waiting for Twitter to go public, huh? Till then, FedEx helped deliver an up session in the markets today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's a long way until the Super Bowl, 6 weeks or so, a couple of regular season games, and the playoffs yet to go. So it's foolish to try to figure out which teams are going to make it. But it's never too early for a story about Super Bowl ads, I'll tell you. That lineup was set months ago, and it says a whole lot about that other big game, the economy. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Take Pizza Hut. The chain is buying its first Super Bowl ad this year. In the past, Pizza Hut bought commercials before the game to give consumers a chance to think ahead to halftime.
Right now, any pizza from Pizza Hut is just $10.
Harry Balzer tracks food trends for the NPD Group. He says Americans are ordering a lot more pizza this year, and Pizza Hut sees the Super Bowl as a way to stay out front in the pizza wars.
Right in the middle of winter comes this one Sunday where everything is different than the Sundays before or the Sundays after, and it captures a lot of people's attention to get a share of that consumption that's going to take place on that day.
Best Buy is also buying into the bowl for the first time, and several car companies like GM and BMW are returning after sitting out the game during the recession. Super Bowl ads have been sold out since October.
Well, it's a huge change from where we've been in recent Super Bowls.
Marketing professor Tim Cockin says ads in the last Super Bowl were still available in January, and he suggests even the Federal Reserve should watch the game, not just to see who wins.
I think the Super Bowl is a wonderful economic indicator because it's really the place where you can see if companies are willing to invest.
And at $3 million an ad?
Clearly this year, you know, all the indicators from the Super Bowl would say that the economy is doing much better.
Now the question is, who's playing? I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Timothy Geithner was up on Capitol Hill today testifying about the TARP. The Treasury Secretary was trying once again to convince a congressional panel that the bank bailout did what it was supposed to do, save the economy after overspeculation in an asset bubble. That is to say, in English this time, all those mortgage-backed securities based on residential real estate. But as we deal with lingering reminders of the subprime mortgage crisis, there is another asset class out there bubbling away, farmland. Prices are up almost 60% over the past decade and still climbing. Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson has more.
8,000 bid, now 8,000, 50,
it's standing room only at this auction just outside of Ames, Iowa. Up for bid are three parcels of farmland that were owned by the same family for three generations. The room is packed with more than 100 people, mostly older farmers in flannel and their wives, and a few out-of-state investors. In the end, an investor from California dropped out. The 80-acre plot sold to a local buyer for nearly $750,000.
I sold it $8,900.
That's $8,900 an acre, double the average price in Iowa from just last year. Farmland prices in the Midwest have been shooting up over the past year and even over the last few months. All this buzz about farmland has caught the attention of the FDIC. Part of the FDIC's job, says Chief Economist Richard Brown, is to worry about these things, to worry about signs that, like the housing market, things could get out of control.
The asset price movement that we're watching right now is farmland values, which have increased by 58% over the past 10 years after inflation.
That's led big financial companies like MetLife, John Hancock, and TIAA CREF to ramp up investment in agricultural land. Part of the reason land prices have risen so high is the soaring cost of crops, a notoriously volatile commodity. Right now, grain is up, but not as much as land prices.
Our sense is that land prices have risen faster than the underlying fundamentals. And again, that's indicative of a boom. But I think what would be more worrisome is if we saw an unstable debt structure under that.
And that last part, that's good news. Farmers and others buying land right now are cash rich, meaning they're able to put money down. So we're not seeing the kind of crazy borrowing that led to the 80s farm crisis. But there are some small signs that make economists wary. Jason Henderson with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City says he's starting to hear that some farmers are borrowing against the high value of their land. He has this example.
Farmers own, say, 500 acres with no debt on it. They're using the equity in that parcel of land to purchase another parcel.
Henderson says there's talk of investors buying farmland as a hedge against inflation. Still, there just isn't that much farmland on the market. Low interest rates and an unstable stock market means that for many farmers, owning land is a better retirement option.
People say, hey, I'd rather own a hard asset, own some farmland, than to, if I convert that to cash and put it in the bank, what will I earn on that?
That's Randy Hertz, president of Hertz Farmland Management Incorporated, based in Iowa. Hertz has been in the business for several decades. He says he's not worried about a bubble, not yet anyway.
If the wheels fall off our commodity markets, which they will go down, what goes up does come down. I do not expect to see the wheels fall off the land market.
The key question is whether high farmland prices are just a result of speculative buying, or are they really supported by farmland's ability to make money? One thing investors are counting on is a continuing demand for that non-luxury item we call food. In Ames, Iowa, I'm Kathleen Masterson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's the most compellingly readable of all of the finance books. And so you tear through it and it doesn't feel like homework in the way that most of these other books do.
No, come on. They're all completely readable. We're never going to give you homework. You know that. Our best business books of the year straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Good news from FedEx today. Absolutely positively boosted markets. The Dow Industrials picked up 41 points, a third of 1%, closed at 11,499. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.75%, 26.37 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, almost 0.75%, finished at 12.42. Despite lower earnings in the third quarter, FedEx predicted stronger profits in the future. The shipping company is seen as a barometer for the economy, as you might have heard. Shares flew 2% higher. Rival UPS caught some tailwinds. Shares lofted more than 2% today. Good day for retail, online, and otherwise. Shares of Amazon ordered up a 1.4% increase. Meantime, department store Macy's dashed nearly 2% higher. Target nailed a half of 1% gain. General Mills said higher prices on frozen vegetables and baking products should help it reach profit targets for the year. Shares puffed up nearly 0.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.43%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at Vanguard.com/public radio. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at Marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Celebrating the entrepreneurial spirit and a serious advancement in air transportation, it's Wright Brothers Day, a day to get your idea off the ground. And ladies, did you drag your man to Sex and the City 2 earlier this year? Well, it's payback time. Tron Legacy opens tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, it's not every day that Save the Planet types go head-to-head with Save the Planet types. Today, though, it was clean power versus habitat protection. The federal government has proposed some new rules that are supposed to open up and speed approval of giant solar farms, so giant they could spread over millions and millions of acres of public lands out west. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong explains.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar knows the deserts have NIMBY issues, too. Historical sites versus habitats versus solar farms. So in a conference call today, he laid out federal zones in six southwestern states with low fuss. Lots of sun, not many living things.
These are areas in those states which have been determined to have the highest solar potential and the fewest amount of environmental and resource conflicts.
And to limit conflict between stakeholders, he laid out ways to design solar projects that feds are likely to approve. Basically a cheat sheet for industry.
Or more than that, it's basically the rules of the game.
Nathaniel Bullard is an analyst with Bloomberg Clean Energy Finance.
You've got the playbook. If you play along, you're likely to be right. And if you don't play along, you do so at your peril. This is very positive for the development of any kind of infrastructure.
He figures this shaves off 5 to 10% of a project's cost, less spent on lawyers and on borrowing. But Alex Duhau at the Wilderness Society has read the nitty-gritty. He says the plan identifies areas conducive to solar plants, but doesn't force companies to build there. They can still apply elsewhere, including more fragile habitats.
This type of scattershot approach that has caused huge problems in the oil and gas development program does not need to be the way we approach clean solar energy on our public lands.
Speaking of fossil fuels, regulators have greenlighted 78,000 projects on federal land in the last two decades. Mega solar farms, 7. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's a philosophy of the workplace that goes, if I might borrow a well-known corporate slogan, just do it. Put your head down and get things done. That's why they call it work, right? So I was intrigued by a company, a successful company, that has put 5,000 employees through a program that sounded a little touchy-feely. Amy Pascal and Michael Linton are co-studio heads at Sony Pictures Entertainment here in L.A. They're doing pretty well, 22 Golden Globe nominations just this week. We met over lunch on the patio outside the studio commissary.
There was an executive dining room, which only executives could eat in. And then there were all these sort of crummy places for people to eat all over the lot. And it was a real class system. And so we said, oh, okay, here's what we should do. We should build a commissary that's completely open. There is really, yes, there's a part that you get served and a part you don't get, but anybody can eat in either part.
And they do.
And on top of that, we subsidize one of the meals.
In fact, you subsidize the healthy meal.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, we did not subsidize the triple hamburger with extra mayonnaise.
The commissary and the open lawn and the free gym nearby are part of Pascal and Linton's goal of building community and sustaining their employees.
They're in line with what science tells us that you actually have to do physically, mentally, emotionally, even spiritually to be able to perform at your best.
Tony Schwartz and his company, The Energy Project, helped Sony Pictures figure out how to work smarter.
We've looked at it with athletes for many years, but it's only recently that we've begun to look at that in the organizational world, and that's because now the urgency they're feeling is as high or higher than athletes feel.
Amy Pascal puts it another way.
It was management speak that didn't sound prissy, it didn't sound touchy-feely, it didn't sound, forgive me, girly. It was really hard-nosed smart stuff.
Like actual science that shows we don't do our best work when we're constantly being interrupted by email or when we're expected to work flat out all the time.
I was first a litigator.
Andrew Gumpert is president of business affairs at Sony Pictures.
I was trained to basically sit at my desk, I mean, literally 6 or 7 hours. I hate to say this without going to the men's room. I thought I was being effective. I didn't feel good.
To help Gumpert unlearn those habits, Tony Schwartz created some new rituals for him. So his day is more a series of sprints instead of one long slog.
Working for, say, 45 minutes really hard and then breaking.
How do you take a break? You work for 45 minutes and then what do you do?
I guess I'm somewhat blessed. There's television and I'll watch ESPN for 10 or 15 minutes. We have a beautiful lot here and take a walk down Main Street. I can go meet a friend. Getting away from BlackBerry, cell phone, so you really feel there's a true physical break.
It's one thing, though, when your boss says you can take a TV break in the middle of the day or a nap or ignore your email after 8 o'clock at night. It's another thing entirely to really believe that. And Michael Linton gets it.
I grew up in the Netherlands, and you have a pretty Calvinist work ethic. And the idea that you take breaks or the idea that you, you know, relax is not sort of part of the bargain of what you get paid for every day.
About that bargain, the part where your company pays you and you work, you don't watch television? After all the soul-searching and the habit-breaking, has any of what Sony's done translated into profit? Here's Amy Pascal again.
I think it will be too soon to see tangible things, but what for sure we've seen are the different divisions of the company working together in a way that they never had before, us being able to get wring more money out of all the things we do because people are working together. Everybody works hard to do the same thing.
There are, says Tony Schwartz, more than 100 studies that link engagement and corporate profitability. He also thinks, by the way, that I need to take apart my routine if I want to be more productive. You can hear what he has to say and get a link to an assessment of your own routine on our website. It is marketplace.org. There is nothing, nothing more boring than a straight-ahead business book. Take it from us. We know. That's why you're not going to find any of them in this next segment, in which some of our regular commentators share their business-related books of the year.
I'm Felix Salmon. I'm a blogger at Reuters, and I loved reading The Big Short this year by Michael Lewis. It's the most compellingly readable of all of the finance books. This is a man who really knows how to write in a way that most journalists just simply don't. And so you tear through it, and it doesn't feel like homework in the way that most of these other books do.
I'm Justin Fox, editorial director of the Harvard Business Review Group. And my favorite business book of the year, it's called Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class by Jacob S. Hacker and Paul Pearson. It's this unbelievably well-done, well-researched, mostly convincing look at the political forces over the past 35 years that, according to Hacker and Pearson, and I think I mostly believe them, have led to more economic inequality in the United States.
Hi, I'm Padmashree Warrior. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for Cisco.
My favorite business book for this past year is a book called Delivering Happiness, written by Tony Hsieh. Tony is the CEO of Zappos. What I really liked about the book is the way he talks about culture in an organization being the primary driver for business success. It's very easy to read, and it's actually like reading a story.
Hi, I'm Tyler Cowen at George Mason University. This year, my favorite business book was Nicholas Philipson's biography of Adam Smith. It showed that Smith is still the greatest economist of all time, wise about human nature, and that he understands the power of capitalism.
I'm Gustavo Ariano. I'm the managing editor for the OC Weekly, and I'm also author of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. And my favorite business book for 2010, it's called The Tex-Mex Grill and Barbacoa Cookbook by Rob Walsh. It tracks the history of the business of Tex-Mex cuisine. It tells us why all of us drink Cadillac margaritas during our happy hours, why we eat nachos at the ballpark, even a chapter about the transnational overinflation of the fajitas market during the 1980s. And if you're a cook, a lot of great recipes.
Hi, I'm Heidi Moore. I write for the New York Times Dealbook, and my favorite book of the year is Greg Farrell's Crash of the Titans, because every page has some new eye-popping anecdote that shows the titans of the financial world at their absolute worst, and sometimes even at their best. And I would highly recommend it to anybody who wants to understand how these deals can go wrong in a very human way.
Just in time for the holidays, we've got a whole new book section on our website. It is called, appropriately enough, The Big Book. Check it out, share your recommendations, and see my top five list of the year as well. It's all online, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
By Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at NovoNordisk-US.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a story to warm the heart. 45 years ago, Dennis Ferguson was living in Southern California, working for the Douglas Aircraft Company. He got laid off at one point, collected $1,100 in unemployment benefits. You fast forward to 2010, he's retired, living in South Carolina, reading, obviously, about California's financial problems. You can't avoid them. He sits down and he writes a check, $10,000, with this in that little memo line they have on checks. Repayment, he wrote, for what California did for me. State law says it's all going to go to the schools. So, Mr. Ferguson, on behalf of everybody out here, thanks a lot. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow picked up 41 points, more than a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about 0.75%. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, almost 0.75%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here.
The size of these awards makes them far more lucrative than playing the lottery.
New rules for whistleblowers tomorrow in the latest installment of our series, Economy 4.0. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.